To build on some great earlier talks, especially Dan's, by talking about some of these questions of what is recovery in the context of a recent concept that's gotten a lot of play in the literature over the last decade, the concept of conservation-reliant species. I should acknowledge my co-authors on a manuscript that we're about to submit on the subject of this talk. As Dan hinted at, the ESA in 1973 proposed a framework where species would be added to the federal list because of the inadequacy of state-level regulations, but then there would be a threshold at which threats had been ameliorated and federal protection was no longer needed. The species would return to state management. The first species that were delisted met this paradigm. They were threatened by issues such as pesticide pollutants that could be addressed by new federal regulations. Nonetheless, time to recovery might be several decades. But where the concept of conservation-reliant species has emerged is in response to the many species that more closely fit this paradigm. For example, Hawaiian native birds that are threatened by avian malaria. Recovery can be conceived on a timeline of evolution of resistance to the disease, which could take centuries or more. So in 2005 and in subsequently in 2010, Mike Scott and his colleagues defined this conservation-reliant species as any species requiring some form of conservation management for the foreseeable future. To these authors, management was a broad spectrum of activities from very intensive management, like population augmentation, through less intensive habitat management. But using such a broad definition of management meant that almost all listed species could be termed conservation reliant. So if you feel that almost all listed species are conservation reliant, what does that mean for the ESA's paradigm of listing as a fixed term that will have a threshold that could lead to recovery? Is that template naive in what's been called the Anthropocene epoch? Or alternately, as some believe, is the conservation-reliant concept merely a stealth attempt to revisit some of the normative basis for the ESA and the status it affords to protection of biodiversity? So we think this is a very relevant concept, especially as the agencies are increasingly citing the literature on conservation reliance. These authors drew from the definition of conservation reliance to suggest some policy implications. Dale Gobley and colleagues felt that continued listing under the ESA may not be the best way to achieve long-term persistence. So there's the issue of how do you define conservation reliance species, and then what does that imply for delisting and recovery? We wanted to make this more concrete, so we used the example of restoration of population connectivity. As conservation genetics becomes more developed, we realize that many species that exist in fragmented populations need connectivity for long-term genetic health, but that often involves managing dispersal through a landscape matrix that is inhabited by humans. So intensive management, in this case translocation of animals between core areas, is an attractive option. That's why we see most references to conservation reliance in delisting and recovery plans involving this issue of connectivity. Going back to something that Dan reviewed, in 1973, lawmakers envisioned the act as focused not only on species, but also on the ecosystems upon which they depend. And the courts have interpreted this to mean that the primary purpose of the ESA is to recover self-sustaining populations in the wild. So how have the agencies interpreted the statute and the subsequent case law? That's a bit inconsistent. We see a number of delisting rules and plans in which the agencies reference conservation-reliant species concept as support for the fact that translocation rather than natural dispersal is acceptable after delisting. In other documents, the focus is more on recovery of self-sustaining wild populations. In fact, the same species, the NRM gray wolf, could be considered conservation reliant in one rule and not in another. The courts, as I said, have only looked at this issue a handful of times. Perhaps the most directly relevant case involves the Yellowstone grizzly bear in 2007. As I said, the delisting rule for this species said that genetic connectivity was important, natural dispersal would be encouraged, but artificial translocation was a backup remedy. This was litigated, and the court concluded that that on that particular point, the litigants' concerns weren't valid because genetic concerns were distant enough that they didn't fall within the foreseeable future, which is the time period over which the Act says that threats to a threatened species should be considered. So you can see that the question of what species are conservation reliant and what that implies for delisting is tangled up with some other aspects of the Act's language that are not well defined. This question, how long is the foreseeable future? How much should we care about threats that take many decades to accumulate? And then the second question is, how much effort do the agencies have to expend to restore self-sustaining populations before they can fall back on more intensive management such as translocation? So we believe these questions are ones in which a well-crafted definition of conservation reliance can help inform the debate and agency policy. But we believe that existing definitions in the literature are so broad that they are not really informative in this context, because a definition that encompasses most listed species confounds two different types of decisions. The normative decision, what costs are society willing to bear to protect endangered species? And then there's a second question that Dan referred to, 21st century threats. What are the ecological and technical characteristics of the specific threats to a specific species? So in our view, those are very different questions. So we'd like to refine the definition of conservation reliant species, make it more useful and narrower, and make it purely based on that second question and ecologically based. In terms of connectivity, the kind of questions that we'd want to ask would be, what level of connectivity is necessary for viability? What ecological challenges exist to restore connectivity? So in our manuscript, we looked at a wide variety of species that have been termed conservation reliant. We looked at how much connectivity they need, from the low levels, perhaps one effective migrant per generation to reduce inbreeding risk, and the other extreme would be migratory populations such as salmon. And then we looked at whether threats or obstacles to restoring connectivity could be resolved through one-time intervention or whether they were essentially required continuing intensive management. When we did this, our classification revealed that the current definition of conservation reliance really lumps together three different types of challenges to species recovery: species with costly threats, distant threats, and what we would say would be truly conservation reliant species. An example of a species with costly threats, Pacific salmon, whose migration is blocked by hydroelectric dams in the Columbia River. It's certainly technically feasible to remove those dams, but the agencies have made an implicit normative decision that the economic costs of that outweigh the biodiversity benefits. Distant threats are somewhat different. They depend on agency and society's definition of the foreseeable future. Many of these genetic threats take decades to accumulate. Restoring connectivity is actually fairly feasible for a species such as the wolf that's a very good disperser. But given the fact that these threats aren't immediate, it's very tempting to say, well, we don't need to address that prior to delisting. And then the third group is what we call truly conservation-reliant species, those dependent on species-specific conservation measures that must be maintained in perpetuity due to lack of technical solutions to permanently reduce key threats. So that's the 21st century challenges that Dan referred to, and we think that Mike Scott and colleagues were onto something useful when they pointed out how that affects our thinking about recovery and delisting. Some of those threats could include invasive species. I talked about avian malaria and Hawaiian birds. Similarly, Sylvatic plague affects black-footed ferrets and their prey and is very difficult to eradicate without ongoing intensive management. This also applies to certain predator species and competitor species. Similarly, invasive species often operate in tandem with altered disturbance regimes. For example, sage grouse are threatened by transformation of their habitat, sagebrush ecosystems. And we know from ecology that once an ecosystem is degraded into an alternate stable state, it may be very difficult to restore it to its historic condition. So that's another instance where intensive management may be required for centuries. And finally, a threat that is starting to affect a number of species, but will increasingly threaten a large number of listed species. Climate change is considered in some sense an irresolvable threat in that current carbon emissions, even if we reduce what we're putting into the atmosphere today, what we've already put into it has a half-life of centuries in some cases. So these three types of threats are examples of 21st century challenges that do challenge the original paradigm that the ESA of 1973 proposed, because there's no technical solution in the foreseeable future that will resolve the need for ongoing intensive management. And this fact is irrespective of society's decision on how much cost or priority it wants to give protection of biodiversity. So you might think, well, this is just an academic debate. What does this really mean on the ground? But in actuality, as we can see, if the services are increasingly looking to the definition of conservation-reliant species to guide their decisions on when to delist, these definitions have real-world consequences in terms of the ultimate status of biodiversity. As Debbie pointed out, services commonly use the 3R framework, and a species that is present in a small, intensively managed population, by definition, will have less resiliency, redundancy, and representation. It will also be less likely to achieve some of the broader goals of the Act, such as a species' role in ecosystems, and also recovery throughout all significant portions of the range. So we believe that these truly conservation-reliant species, the decision when to delist, does combine normative and technical questions. So the debate that was begun by Mike Scott and colleagues is important in bringing this to the fore. We don't agree with Dale Gobley that all of these species necessarily should be delisted and returned to state management. The ESA does offer quite a bit of flexibility in working with the states, but it is important for the agencies and the public to start thinking about what new tools may be needed to better prioritize long-term recovery efforts and make them more efficient for these kind of species that may require intensive management for centuries. But we think applying this same paradigm of conservation reliance so widely that it encompasses most listed species is really far broader than just that technical question. It's a normative attempt to revisit a question that was asked in the Act: is self-sufficiency in the wild one of the conditions of recovery? So we believe that if you feel, as some have proposed, that most listed species will be conservation reliant in perpetuity, that really moves us towards this zookeeper paradigm where we're just looking at recovery of intensively managed, narrowly distributed populations. And we think that the original intent of the Act, which is still highly relevant today, is more of a restoration paradigm, where recovery of self-sustaining populations that can play their historic role in ecosystems. Thank you.